Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Colin McCormick.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we're coming back with another installment in our newest segment we're trying out, tentatively titled Extremely Strained and Incredibly Forced, where we search for meaning in various pop culture artifacts. And today's a very special episode because, as I was explaining in my first take, this is an episode idea that's been percolating for at least a year. Fairly early on in this podcast's history, we were sort of talking about this idea. So it's been a while. It's been a long time coming. But we're joined by special guest, repeat guest, Dr. Adam Rabinowitz, who has come here today to tell us about The Wire. So, Adam, you got it.
Thank you, Colin. I hope I'm not the first episode, because I think that I am not as forced as some of the pitches you're going to hear. And
we'll see. They're coming out. We have one come out. We got another one that's coming down the pipe. So there will be another one. You're good. At least, I think, one of the first ones that's not about the Aeneid. So that's a plus. Yes.
Well, that's good. This is not completely off the wall. So let me give you a little bit of background. I'm a repeat guest primarily because I dragged students in my undergraduate signature course at UT, Tales of the Trojan War, onto the show to review the Netflix and BBC drama Troy, Fall of a City, which I think they did quite expertly in three installments, and many people had lots of opinions about this show, which was a fun way to get them thinking about the way that the story of the Trojan War has been retold, which is really the purpose of that course. And so I've been teaching that course since 2008. I think I've taught it 12 times now, which is a long time, and most iterations have the students writing short papers where they find some work that retells part of the Iliad and compare it to the Iliad itself as a moment of close reading and literary criticism in the course. So I have seen a lot of retellings of the Iliad, and they, at this point, tend to repeat, although every time I get something new. And I also walk the course through retellings, starting with adaptations by Greek playwrights and walking through Roman literature and into the Middle Ages, into epics of chivalry in the 12th century and through Shakespeare and up through the 19th century and into the 20th and 21st. So I've spent a lot of time finding retelling of this story. And I have noticed over the years that America sucks at retelling the Iliad. We do a really terrible job. We make some interesting movies that are fun to watch. And I do have the students watch the Brad Pitt Troy the sort of culmination of the course. It's important.
A landmark in American cinema.
Exactly. But we never really managed to get right the idea of appropriating the Iliad or its sort of core stories and values and retelling it. And in the process of attempting to do this in the 19th century and then at various moments over the course of the 20th and 21st, we get some really tragicomic attempts. And I love watching these show up. I had a student this year who wrote on something called the Chiliad, in which the Iliad is a frat conflict. I have acquired in my search for weird Iliadic derived literature, a Houston Iliad, in which Achilles is a lone wolf biker fighting with two organized crime families in Houston with lots of local Houston landmarks in color. So if you are from Houston, check this out. But it has been a real problem in our attempts to claim our place at the epic table. And one of the things I focus on with the students in this class is the way in which each rising power tries to seize that narrative and that legacy to legitimize its own place in world history. So Virgil seizes it for the Romans with the Aeneid, and then the Greeks try a little bit to take it back with the account of Dictys, which casts the Trojans in a worse light than Virgil does. And then you have its appropriation by 12th century French chivalrous poetry, and you've got Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida. So you have these moments where a new rising power seizes on the story and tries to take the idea of the destiny, specifically of Troy itself, not so much of the Greeks after the Greeks have less to say by the time you get to the end of the unified Roman Empire. But the people who see themselves as the heirs of the Roman Empire, and by being the heirs of the Roman Empire, they also have to be the heirs of the Trojans. So you get these really strange constructs, like the idea that the island of Britain is established by a runaway Trojan named Brutus, who has to kill some giants in order to civilize the island and prepare it for the Tudor monarchy.
Wild.
Yeah.
So good stuff. And you would have thought that America, in the period in which it was establishing itself as an international force, or at least as a peer to some of the older European powers, would have seized on this. And we tried. Oh, did we try in the early 19th century? We tried so much. By way of Alexander Pope's rhyming couplet, Iliad, and Milton. And the results were pretty uniformly terrible. We had a long epic poem called The Columbiad, which was an allegorical dream of Columbus that sort of charted the destiny of the New World, Jeremiah Barlow. We had an epic poem focused on the American Revolution, also comical, impossible to find now. You would think that the Internet Archive or HathiTrust had digitized it, but no, probably because its print run was quite small. And if you will indulge me, you can always cut this in post, but I want to read you a couple of passages.
Oh my God, please.
We cut nothing. It all stays in.
So my two favorites, one of them I cover in the class, one of them I generally don't, but they are both great. Because they are both, again, a combination of Alexander Pope's Iliad and Milton and Paradise Lost. So they have these long disquisitions in which heaven and hell are allegorically represented. And there are lots of references to various personified values and virtues and various things setting the destiny of America. And they were really trying to figure out what the epic tale of America is. It didn't quite... The Columbian dream didn't quite take. The Revolutionary War didn't quite take. So our other options are the Manifest Destiny expansion to the West. And as it happens, because I think they lost interest by about the middle of the century, the War of 1812, appropriately Iliadic topic. So several people attempted to write Iliadic epics about frontiersmen, including Daniel Boone. Who was a long hunter and did lots of things, but was not in the mold of the Alexander Pope style aristocratic epic hero. And I want to give you a couple of lines of Daniel Bryan's The Mountain Muse from 1813, in which Boone is off in the wilderness and he wants to go home and see his wife and children, but he knows that he has to keep going and enlighten everything. So this is what he realizes and how he continues on to expand the frontier. But he too well a hero's duty knew to bury in privation-brooded glooms, in the dark shadow of domestic woe, the kindling sparks of useful enterprise, which promised by gradations to expand until their bright illumination spread through the barbarian blackness of the West. And right. Wow, there is a lot of that.
Nice.
A lot to unpack there.
Yeah. So one of the problems that we have is that it was a little too soon when Brian was writing this. Brian was Boone's nephew and Boone was still alive.
Yeah,
Boone was actually quite upset and said that he wished that he could sue his nephew for slander, having attempted to read this poetry. And then he said, such productions ought to be left till the person was put in the ground.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm of a mind with Daniel Boone here.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a great book on the American epic by McWilliams, and McWilliams goes on to say this comment may be the only instance in literary history of a cultural hero remarking on the epic poem made of his exploits. So, a little too soon, and it's taking people who are pretty rough around the edges and then attempting to present them in the most erudite and gentlemanly of fashions, which makes those rough around the edges men feel kind of peeved about the whole enterprise.
Adam, you've actually given me an idea that I want to circle back around to at the end, but nice. about like what the true American Iliad might be, because I just had a thought about it.
Well, I'm going to argue that we have it, mm-hmm. that we have it as true as we're going to get it, but there is always room, right? The Houston Iliad proves that you can just keep going if you want. So part of the problem is that Daniel Boone is still alive and not very happy about this and not at all as eloquent as his incarnation in this epic poem, who sort of wanders around the wilderness being enraptured by the glories of nature and the civilizing mission of the Americas. And the other is that we don't like the idea either that anybody is constrained by fate or by doom. That is, Americans mm-hmm. are winners, not people who are likely to win now and then lose again later.
Right.
And we don't really like the idea of having opposed characters who are both either equally good or equally bad or generally morally ambiguous. So Boone is the good guy. The Native Americans are the bad guys.
Right.
So are
right.
the ruffians who are robbing people. And good guys are morally pure and unsullied and have no complexity. And bad guys are universally evil and terrible and do the worst kinds of things. So we know who is good and who is bad, and so does God, and there we go. And this makes it really difficult to capture the sense of fate and doom and ambiguity and equivalence that you have in the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
So at least Daniel Bryan was kind of a poet and did interesting things, but the work that I teach in class is the longest and among the least good. I don't want to say worst, because this poor guy spent a really long time on this poem and it prefaces it with an extended apology for all of the mistakes. And if you think it's bad, maybe it's just us. And if we waited some longer time, then it would turn out that it was actually a really good poem. And you never know what the critics will say in 100 years, but they are still saying that it is not a very good poem. Unfortunately, 200 years later, not quite the 200th anniversary. We're at 195. And this is a work called The Freedoniad by a doctor in North Carolina named Richard Emmon.
Subtle. I like it.
Yes. About freedom, America, and the War of 1812. It runs to 33,000 lines of rhyming couplets.
Oh, my God.
And it is rough going. It's not even Pope, and Pope is pretty rough going for the Iliad. It's about twice as long as the actual Iliad itself.
Oh my God. I read a few lines of this because you sent us a copy, and I was like, what is this?
But it is the American epic, right? He is attempting to immortalize American victory over the very evil British, whose plans are spawned in hell by Satan, literally, at the beginning of the poem. And glorify the Americans whose founding fathers now reside in heaven under the shining eyes of God in celestial majesty, where they consort with the personifications of all of the virtues and graces and things like that. But I want to give you his opener, which gives you a sense of his prose. That's your main Aeneide moment. And then I'm going to give you one of his Homeric epics, one of his Homeric similes, sorry, which are rare, but he's trying very hard. So this was published in 1827 by himself. I think he had his brother finance it. And as far as we know, really nobody has ever read the whole thing. I've maybe halfway. I'm not even sure I made it that far because it's hard. Here it is. Of loud impetuous war, whose brazen tongue hath round the borders of Columbia rung, waged to maintain the freedom of the sea and independence, righteous liberty, I venturous sing, which made Britannia feel a blow that caused her stubborn joints to kneel. So that is his invocation and opening. We know his topic. He has very few actual characters. It's mainly allegories and personifications and historical people who make rousing speeches about battles, and then lots and lots of battles in great detail in various parts of North America where the newly formed United States were fighting the British. And occasionally he will slip into Homeric simile, as here. As when a cloud comes scowling from the west, with heaven's artillery pouring from its breast, chambers of hail their frozen stores expend, the small hills tremble, trees with groans descend, a whirlwind pestilence involves the sphere, grim specters clad in thunder robes appear, the herds in panic to their covert hie, a shuddering wildness glaring from their eye. So, like the sudden bursting of the storm, the bellowing brass the elements deform, so, like the herds, the Britons shun the blast, flying the bulwarks with their souls aghast. I didn't even give you, he also has some really great rhymes. Sometimes he rhymes liberty with things like I. So he's got, you've got to do the William Blake kind of libertai. So anyway, this is also not a great match for the Iliad, partly because of its length, partly because of its turgidity, and partly because it has no characters and no moral ambiguity at all. There are good guys and bad guys. The Americans are the good guys, promoted by God, and the British are the bad guys, supported by the devil. So there you have it. And we, as black and white things go, there we are. So the themes that an American Iliad might treat, and I'll come back to the idea of the West, and especially of the 19th century West and cowboys, don't lend themselves to epic poetry. Mm-hmm. And the things that you might think would lend themselves to epic poetry don't lend themselves to ambiguity or ambivalence or fate or doom, because it's just about Americans winning because God is on our side, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I will leave this particular moment in American epic history with a quote that McWilliams provides from Herman Melville, who was acquainted with this work while he was working on Moby Dick and while he was reading Milton and Pope's Iliad. And he says the following: "I was much pleased with a hot-headed Carolina cousin of mine who once said, if there were no other American to stand by in literature, why then I would stand by Pop Emmons and his Fredoniad until a better epic came along. Swear it was not very far behind the Iliad. Take away the words, and in spirit, he was sound." I mean, that's a right opinion, except for the part where he actually talks about the Fredoniad.
Right.
So we don't have a great track record. And in the 20th century and into the 21st, we tended to limit ourselves to attempting to retell Homer's Iliad in quintessentially American media like film and television. And generally getting it kind of wrong, you know, in degrees. But this is the pitch. I think that the Omar Little arc in The Wire is actually the best rendition of an Iliad for the United States of America that has been produced in the history of the country. And I will tell you why I think that. Stop me if you want to spend more time talking about terrible 19th century.
Well, it was funny that you said Melville, because my thought was like, well, I think maybe our best epic work is probably Moby Dick. And just terms of like a very American sort of epic in nature, even though it's not prose or not prose, sorry, it's not verse, it's not an epic, it's not about Troy really in any sense of the way. But like, if we were to write an Iliad, I think Moby Dick is actually maybe like the best thing. And then everybody who knows me is probably groaning audibly, because I'm about to go on about Moby Dick, which is a whole other thing. So I'll leave it there. But yeah, no, when you pitched this, it'd been a minute since I've seen any of The Wire. And when you mentioned Omar, I was like, I see where he's going now with this, right?
I was just going to say, I like the point of like why it's so difficult, especially in American. Actually, when I was hearing some of it, what it reminded me is the rhetoric they use for multi-level marketing now, the religious overtone, the morality and aspects of like that is like, ooh, that's haunting, because I've been watching like the Lululemons or whatever it is, yeah, that stuff. Yeah. And so it's like this aspect of why I love, you know, the Greeks is the gods are amoral and they have stakes in the game for petty reasons. And it's the same for all the individuals. And that's what makes it so interesting. I remember one of my first questions I ever asked Elijah is like, what side do you see yourself rooting for? Like when you read the Iliad, because you know, it's more like you get attached to certain characters and you don't really have a good sense of like which side is good or bad. It's just, who do you find most interesting and hang around for the ride? And so I think that was an excellent point. So I'm glad that's leading into this show, because I think that was a good point to make.
Yeah. Yeah. In rewatching the episodes that you sent us, it was very clear, like, oh, these, I love this character. Or mm-hmm. like D'Angelo, I was like, you know, rewatching that his arc was like, no. Mm-hmm. And you feel so many things for people who are on different, maybe even arbitrary sides of things. And so I'm really seeing where you're going with this ambiguity. And I'm really excited about it. So please keep talking.
Well, in fact, the fundamental thing that you just mentioned about D'Angelo and other characters is that all of those attempts to make the American epic were about how Americans can only win.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And The Wire is about how everybody inevitably always loses.
Yes.
That the game is rigged. Mm-hmm. The odds are stacked against you. And no matter what you do, you're always going to end up at the bottom. And I think this is the central message of the Iliad, that in this kind of conflict, you can win for a while, but you know that no matter how good you are, you're going to get it in the end. Mm-hmm. And Achilles is constantly reminded of this by, you know, by his mother, by his friends, by himself, horses. By his horse, yep. Right? Which is always a favorite with the students in this class. They're like, did his horse just say, you're going to die, Achilles? Don't blame me. Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
Yes, it did.
But in this world of Baltimore that the Wire is presenting, deliberately, the odds are always against you. And there is always this set of impersonal forces that are going to grind you down, no matter what your qualities and your morality and your code. Mm-hmm. And this, so here's the thing. I have some original, what I think are original parts of this argument, but I said that it was not off the wall because it is not me making it for the first time. So let me walk you through what's already out there in terms of The Wire as a Greek influence thing. And then we can go from there. And I'll tell you why I think specifically that there is an Iliadic component that gets the Iliad better than most of the other things that I've seen. So first of all, David Simon gave a ton of interviews starting in 2002, which is when The Wire started being broadcast. So 20 years now, where he said, The Wire is basically all about Greek tragedy again and again mm-hmm. in a series of interviews with basically anybody who would listen. And I'll give you a quote from the New York Times from an interview he did in 2002. Because I think it's useful for any college students who might be in your audience and thinking, why am I being forced to take classics classes? But David Simon says this. He says, we stole from the Greek tragedies the idea that the institutions were the gods and they were bigger than the people. So thanks to the college course that made me read Greek plays. And he gave an interview to another scholar who was writing on this, in which he said that when he started the show, he reread Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides in order. So his use of tragedy is clear and explicit and said by him, although he will not say, I use this play or this character is based on this character. And in fact, really heavily resists the idea that there is any direct influence that he's trying to convey or symbolism. I read an interview with David Simon where the interviewer starts asking him about symbolism and he shuts him right down. Like, don't ask me about this. It's not relevant. It's not important. I refuse to talk about it, which is an authorly move, right? Oh, I'm not going to tell you what the secrets are. I'm not going to dissect this work for you. It's not about the
one-to-one
technical elements. It's about how you feel about it.
Isn't that like, didn't Tolkien famously, he has a big rant about why he hates allegory because it locks the reader in and then the story becomes in service to the allegory, the other thing it's referencing.
Mm-hmm. And there's a quote by Garcia Marquez somewhere as well, where somebody tried to get him to explain something that was going on in 100 Years of Solitude. And he was like, I'm just a writer. I just write stuff that I think is neat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No.
So it is a standard dodge. But I will say that in all of the interviews that I looked at, he never talks about the Iliad specifically. Talks about tragedy constantly. Never talks about the Iliad. Mentions Achilles himself, however, once in an interview with the New Yorker. But what he's interested in is this idea that there is this system that is amoral and uncaring and capricious and that simply crushes you for no good reason because it's there. Mm-hmm. And it's serving the interests of powerful forces that are themselves untouchable and inexplicable. And that, I think, is where he's coming from with respect to tragedy. But of course, that's present in the way that the gods act in the Iliad as well. Mm-hmm. I also want to note that his co-developer of the series, Ed Burns, was a former Baltimore police officer, but also spent 7 years teaching middle school in Baltimore, mm-hmm. In East Baltimore. And I couldn't find this when I went to track it down for this conversation, but I remember seeing somewhere that he had talked about his students in Baltimore middle schools learning about Greek myth and being really excited about it. So inner city kids, but something about that resonated with them. So the Greeks are right there explicitly. No one has to do a kind of deep dive to figure out that maybe they might be talking about it. They keep saying, I am definitely talking about Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
in defense of your point, also, it's in the show, right? There's a part, I think it's in season one or two.
That's part of my thing.
Okay, never mind. I'll stop that.
So the other thing that we're getting here is the influence of Westerns, Western movies and cowboys, and specifically the kind of lone gunslingers who show up all the time. Especially for the Omar arc, mm-hmm. right? This violent society without a lot of rules, without a lot of intervention from authority or law, except in ways that are arbitrary and unfair. And a lot of sudden violence, a lot of defense of honor. And this is the other area where people have attempted to make somewhat more convincing American Iliad. And there's a great recent spoken word album by a singer named Walter Hill, which tells a story of a bar fight in Texas in the 19th century. It's not even in Texas. It's in like Oklahoma or Kansas, I think. And that mythos is another part of our own sort of Iliadic world that could be exploited. But the problem is, again, that it is difficult to make that grand rather than just kind of dirty and scuffly and petty and bloody and purposeless. So, but that's part of that underlying influence on the way The Wire lets this story unfold. So that's the background for the series as a whole. And then several people have argued that there is an Iliadic component to Omar's character. There is a long argument by a guy named Chris Love in the journal Criticism in 2010 about Greek myths and The Wire in general, which sees the Oresteia as the best parallel, the play, the trilogy by Aeschylus that records the return of Agamemnon from Troy and his death at the hands of Clytemnestra, and Clytemnestra and her lover's death at the hands of Orestes, and Orestes' flight to Athens and eventual trial and purification. He's not focused on the Iliad and doesn't mention it that much. In 2011, a blogger named Jason Kotke, who has a blog called Kotke, which has been around for nearly 30 years now, I think, made a quick argument that Omar was a postmodern Achilles. And his argument was based on two scenes. One of them was our introduction to Omar. So Omar is gay. He has a lover named Brandon. And after they knock over a stash house where drugs and drug money are being kept, Brandon is identified by a very young Michael B. Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And tortured and murdered to try to get to Omar by the crew of on the orders of Stringer Bell, who is one of the main characters in those first couple of seasons. And Jason Kotke notices the scene in which Omar is brought by Detective McNulty to identify Brandon's body and his anguish at looking at this body and the way he falls on the body. And he sees this as an echo of the scene of Achilles recognizing and falling on the body of Patroclus when it's brought back to the Greek camp in the Iliad. And the other scene, Colin, and this is why I stopped you, the other scene is the scene where Omar has come into court to testify falsely, but to put away somebody who has shot a civilian, and he's helping McNulty and McNulty's partner, Bunk. And at the very beginning of that episode, he's sitting with the bailiff outside the courtroom, and the bailiff is struggling with a crossword puzzle. And he says, what is the god of war? Is it Mars? Isn't it Mars? And Omar says, yeah, and also a planet. And the bailiff says, I can't make this fit. It's four letters, but Mars doesn't work. Greek god of war. And Omar says, Ares. Ares is the Greek god of war. Different name, same guy. And of course it is Ares, and the bailiff says, hey, thanks a lot. And Omar explains that in middle school, he really liked Greek myths and felt that they spoke to him. So that was the one you were going to say, Colin, right?
Yes, that's exactly it. Which is exactly kind of echoing, not David Simon, the other crew. It's directly echoing the real life story of Ed Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And his experiences as a teacher. And also very much like kind of on the note, because, you know, Ares is frequently invoke, you know, when Achilles goes to kill Hector, for example, or do whatever he's going to do, you know, he is invoked or Ares is mentioned or something is Ares like, or something that brings Ares, or, you know, and also as, you know, Omar as a figure of sort of like vengeance and violence and retribution, which is, I mean, that's Achilles to a T. Yet most of his arc, at least up and through season three-ish, is a vengeance arc, particularly as inspired by the death of Brandon.
Mm-hmm. I think what stood out to me on like the rewatch of these episodes was when Omar is like in the office, the like basement office that they have, and they're talking to him about like what are you willing to like give up? And he says something of like, the way I feel right now, and then he can't even continue. It's like he has so much anger and he feels so passionately about what has just happened to him and his lover, his boyfriend, someone that he really cared about. And I'm like, that's what really got me. I was like, I see like the love that Achilles had for Patroclus in this, like in this feeling. That was really cool.
I was also struck that McNulty looks away at the anguish she's experiencing. And it's not necessarily clear to me if like that's kind of, you know, he's weirded out because there's a homophobic element there that's playing out, or if it's just like another man showing such anguish at the loss of another man is really hard. And then you also, the scream itself scares the kids and the security camera in the background. Yeah. Like the loss is scarier. And like Omar is scary. Like people see him on the street, they hear his name, they're like, watch Omar's out for coming. That guy. Yeah. And that's something about, you know, we keep talking about the rage of Achilles, like that's how the Iliad opens, but it's like, but it really, he's the scariest when he has this loss.
And to also bring in, Adam, you mentioned like the Western element, which I'm seeing now, particularly later, where we get the character of Brother Mazzone. We get the character of Brother Mazzone, where like a feature of both the Western and epic is like the dual nature of like heroic combat, right? Where two captains or heroes or whatever are going to square off and have a duel. Like all of the fighting in the Iliad is all duels. I mean, there's obviously like massed combat happening around them, but all the stuff that gets described sort of at any length is usually sort of duels between various heroes. And that kind of like singular combat sort of element, which we get, you know, Omar is this kind of heroic, larger than life fighter. And he has his signature, like he has a special shotgun that he likes, and he sings the whistle that he does, the coat that he wears. It's all very kind of like, these are his arms and armaments, his trappings, right? You could paint Omar or make a sculpture of Omar, and you'd be able to tell it was Omar immediately because of his outfit and his armaments and things like that, in the way that you could tell like a Greek hero or something like that.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're totally right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the duster is Western, but the shotgun is the ash spear.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Achilles famously has a spear that like only he can use, or it's like, and it's given like special lengths and descriptions. And
so can I come back to something that Christy said? Cause I'm going to jump ahead. There's another work on this by a scholar named Adam Gantz in a book on sort of reception of Greek myth from 2016, where he makes a more explicitly Iliadic argument. And he talks about that scene with Patroclus's body, and he misses the scream. And I think that he is interested in the parallelism with Achilles and Patroclus and the strong emotion. But here is point one, where I'm going to argue that this is not just structural parallelism with the figure of Achilles, but the Iliad. Because the most representative moment of Achilles' grief in the Iliad, there's the moment where he hears from Antinous that Patroclus is dead. He throws himself on the ground, and Antilochus has to restrain him so that he doesn't kill himself. And then he doesn't know what to do because he doesn't have any armor. Patroclus went off with it and lost it. And he decides, or it is suggested to him, that he still has his voice. And he goes to the edge of the Greek fortifications and he yells. And the sound is so loud and so terrifying that the Trojans start in fear and run away. And it's not just that scream that you hear indirectly. So it's, you don't see Omar scream. You go back into the hallway, as Christy said, with McNulty's kids who are kicking around a soccer ball. And this terrifying roar of anguish sounds out. And they look terrified and they drop their soccer ball and it rolls away down the hall, and that shift, it shifts to the security camera, the sort of, you know, God's eye view of what's going on. No people in that scene, just this rolling soccer ball as the echoes of that scream resonate. And that scream itself was so powerful for later readers that the one World War I poem by Patrick Shaw Stewart, who only wrote the one poem, but everybody somehow knows it in classics, about going back to Gallipoli and asking Achilles whether it was so hard to die, ends with Shaw Stewart saying, "Stand in the trench, Achilles, flame-capped, and shout for me." So that shout is that is Iliad. That is a way that the Iliad is expressing grief and pain, which is interpreted by the wire in such a way that all of the grief and pain remains intact. And Omar cries too, not just then, but in various places. And Achilles cries, right? This is one of those things. Whereas manly men don't cry, right? But that is a part of Homeric masculinity that is preserved here. Not so much a part of Western conventions, right? The Clint Eastwood Man with No Name, they never cry, right? Yeah. They never cry. They are upset, but they don't cry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I think nobody has really pointed out is a specific and direct reference to the Iliad. If you want to say, David Simon, mm-hmm. were you reading the Iliad? Did you know this scene? And he would say, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want you to ask me about symbolism, but he definitely was.
Yeah.
Sorry, Colin, you wanted to say
something. No, this is just to even build off, and not quite as strong, but I thought you were going to say, this is the part that I talk a lot about when I sort of talk about the Iliad or teach it or something like that, is when Achilles is there with Patroclus's body and talking about it, we get this one of my favorite similes where he's described like a lion that's whose cubs have been taken, and the lion goes roaming out in the forest looking for whoever took the cubs. And this is priming us to know that Achilles is going to go off and just basically go on the warpath, which is exactly what Omar does, right? He just goes on basically a killing spree, you know, to seeking retribution, and it will continue on after he gets retribution for Brendan's death. But like that Omar almost becomes like, he becomes like fierce and ferocious, like, you know, he becomes lion-like in a sense. Sorry, but you were saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, but he does. And I think we go back and forth, at least in my reading of this arc and these scenes, between a kind of structural parallelism, which you can talk about, and which goes back to this idea of Greek myth, right? So Omar is a man outside of hierarchies. He is following a moral code that he has set for himself, even if other people don't follow it, which Achilles is constantly talking about. He has a secret weakness, right? That is, he doesn't expect somebody who is weaker than him to attack him. And Omar's death, and I hope, you know, after 20 years, I'm not spoiling anything. Omar dies an Achilles-style death at the hands of a much weaker attacker with a weapon used at a distance, right? So in the epic tradition, Achilles is shot in the heel by Paris. And this is hinted at in what Achilles is told by various characters in the Iliad, right? That you're going to be brought down by Paris and Apollo, the archer god, in front of the sky and gates. And Omar is killed by Kennard, one of the very young school children from the last season that focuses on a middle school experience, who sees him in a convenience store and walks up behind him and shoots him in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
Without any further, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. So the death itself is this somewhat inglorious death at the hands of a much weaker opponent in a way that doesn't really befit Achilles. And this is a part of the Iliad that is not in the Iliad itself at all, but a part of the Homeric or the epic tradition, let's say, that persists all the way through the Middle Ages to the point where there is an English 15th century, 14th century burlesque poem based on the story of the Trojan War, in which Achilles dies by being held down and stabbed repeatedly in the soles of his feet in the course of an ambush. So this idea of the foot is another parallel, but I would say that, you know, there are lots of ways that you can create parallels without making a direct reference to any specific tradition about Achilles. But when Omar catches up with Stringer Bell, he finds him. Stringer is attempting to pursue this real estate development plan that he's trying to use to create an empire in a more standard and sort of sanctioned way. And he's having problems with the contractor who is taking advantage of him. And he is ambushed by Omar and Brother Muzone, who are now working together. And I really feel that Brother Muzone is kind of a minor Olympian character. He doesn't say much. He seems to be extremely powerful. He gets enigmatic. Shot in the abdomen, but survives just fine in the same way that Ares gets stabbed in the abdomen by Diomedes and Athena and survives just fine.
Interesting.
And then he participates in this ambush of Stringer Bell, who has used him to try to get to Omar. And instead of having a duel where Omar shows up and then they exchange words and Stringer Bell tries to draw a gun and Omar gets him first in Western style, without any speech at all, Omar and Muzone come in. They shoot the bodyguard person who's hanging out with Stringer Bell. And without thinking, Stringer Bell turns and he runs. And he runs up the stairs and he tries to find an exit. And Muzone cuts him off and he's trapped. And then he tries to bargain with Omar, says, "Do you want money?" And then when he realizes the bargaining isn't going to work, he says, "Just do it then." And this is exactly, without the bit of duel that you have between Hector and Achilles, where Hector ineffectually throws his spear and attempts to get Achilles. This is the scene of Achilles and Hector and the vengeance. Hector doesn't stand, he runs. And then he stops because Athena shows up in the guise of his brother Deiphobus and says, "I'm here, right behind you. The two of us can definitely take Achilles." And then Hector throws his spear and he doesn't get it back. And Athena swats it aside and he turns to his brother to say, "Give me your spear." And there's no brother there. Mm-hmm. And this is that moment of recognition when it's done. When Muzone comes down the stairs for the one exit that Stringer Bell still has.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, this is something that actually I thought of between the time that I proposed this to y'all and now, because I was thinking, in none of the versions of the Iliad that I've seen retold, in all this time, in all of the examples that I've looked at or been given, in none of them does the Hector figure ever run. We find it completely incomprehensible as a modern audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is one of those things that I think has been, at least for, like you said, modern audience, is one of the hardest parts to reconcile of you know, and people have, I've heard arguments where like, well, he runs three times around the entire city. Like even when he's fleeing, Hector's still epic or something like that. But it is a hard nut to crack, particularly when you've been conditioned by the last 100 or so years of American cinema or whatever pop culture to like, to have even if Hector were our villain or is our hero or something like that, that he would behave in such a way.
The only example I've seen is Horrible Histories. They do a sports casting style matchup between Achilles and Hector. And it's meant for, you know, for laughs that Hector runs away because it's like everyone knows he's going to lose going into this match.
Yeah.
Hector knows that's the only time I've seen a representation of it.
Mm-hmm. And I had two thoughts and I'm trying to get them in order. One, like Omar's kind of unheroic and sudden and almost random death and as well as sort of Stringer Bell's and even to go back to Gelangelo, I think one of the kind of strengths of The Wire, and even, you know, people talk about this like with Game of Thrones, that like, you know, Game of Thrones could kill off any character you like, you know, at any given moment, nobody has ever said, but The Wire did it first, where, you know, and a lot of these characters, their deaths come sudden and unexpectedly. Like Omar, we have no clue, or not with Omar, sorry, with Stringer Bell, we have no clue his death is coming that episode necessarily and until it just happens. And then, you know, it happens in a way that it's emblematic of, you know, the way the game grinds you down and all of the characters sort of are, who, you know, they're in these violent lives that could just turn on them at any given instance. Same for D'Angelo, same for Omar and
Cheese, Wagstaff, Method Man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where he's in the middle of a speech about how it's his new empire and then
all die.
Yep.
Just get shot in the head.
Well, I was just going to add to go with that Achilles knows his death is coming as prophesized. This seemed like one of the instances that Omar's death wasn't prophesized, but it was foreshadowed earlier in the season. So I thought that was kind of
interesting. And Omar probably to some extent has no illusions about how he's going to die. It just probably isn't in that particular, he doesn't imagine it in that sort of particular way, but like that he would be killed violently, I think would surprise no one, himself included.
Well, yeah, at the beginning he says, or when he's testifying, they say like, oh, how have you like done this for 8 years? You rob drug dealers? And he's like, one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that has to be like very similar for, you know, anybody in the business of war, you know, mm-hmm. a couple thousand years ago. Is like, you make it one day at a time. So you pass one battle. Great. Awesome. Things are great today. But it's like, it could all change immediately.
And that's kind of Stringer's whole tragedy is yeah. Stringer's entire drive is to escape this cycle, right? Is to get out of the grind, to get out of this sort of this game that he's in and go legit and become like, and we could, there's all you know, many pages of thought to be sort of spelled about like the way Stringer goes about sort of like legitimizing yourself or projecting legitimacy and the way he behaves and cavorts and like the way the fact that he like holds the drug lord meetings in like a Marriott ballroom, you know, like it's a conference, but he's trying to get out of the conflict in some ways, you know, not again, like the Stringer Bell Hector parallel is not a one-to-one and it's, you know, it's not going to work in all situations, but in a sense that I don't know, you can imagine Hector like just wanting the conflict. Like he deliberates ways to get out of the conflict or to end the war, but then even he can't escape and no one can escape this, the meat grinder that is Troy.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, this is why I think The Wire works so well in getting at the truth of the Iliad, if not mm-hmm. the exact events. It's not meant to be a mapping. If you make a mapping of a live thing onto a dead thing, it's not going to work. This mm-hmm. is all of these epics fall flat because they are attempting to do what Virgil or Homer did. And you can't. It doesn't make any sense, mm-hmm. especially as you get further and further away in time. But there are these moments of truth and stillness. And this is why I think it's so brilliant, because it hits those moments. It's got the general structural parallel. This is why Simon keeps saying, stop asking about the symbolism. He doesn't want you to think about it in terms of, well, is this this? Is mm-hmm. this thing this other thing? It's not. It is itself. Right. But these underlying fundamental things resonate regardless of the moment in which they're happening. That scream, the running, it doesn't feel forced. It doesn't feel weird. You don't say like, oh, that's Hector running. I didn't think of it until much later because it seems entirely natural. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in being yeah. entirely natural, it naturalizes the moment in the Iliad that everybody always struggles with, because they're like, but you're supposed to be brave. Why did you run away? Because our conventions of bravery and heroism all involve not running away. But yeah. of course, you see Omar coming, you run away. It's yeah. basic yeah. self-preservation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's human reaction. It's, yeah, you want to live. Like we've already seen, you know, the things that maybe Hector has to live for, his family. The things that Stringer has to live for, his, you know, going legit, all of these things that he wants. His
super nice apartment.
Yeah, sure, fine. But like, you know, I don't know. It felt, again, natural, like you said. It's like, I didn't think that that was weird. It's like, of course I would run.
Yeah.
Like you see Omar coming at you, of course you run.
And I will say at least my reaction to this scene, even after being upset about things that Stringer Bell did, you kind of want him to get away, even though you know he's not going to. In the same way that you always want Hector to get away,
yeah.
even though this happened, the poem has been around for 2,800 years. If it happened, it happened 400 years before that. He definitely did not get away, and he's not going to do it this time. But every time, I'm kind of like, but maybe this time he'll make it, right? Like,
right.
Yeah. That moment.
Yeah. And we kind of forget that, like, survival is its victory, but ultimately you'll never win that game because someday you die. One way yeah. or another.
Another thought, going back to victory, or if you can call it that, that Omar has over Stringer Bell, is like in doing so, that actually sort of undermines maybe a victory that an American media or an audience familiar with American media would probably expect, which is for McNulty to catch Stringer Bell, like in a less good show than The Wire. Mm-hmm. McNulty's amazing detective work and perseverance and bootstrapping would get the case on Omar, bring him down legitimately, send Omar to jail, and you know, we would have our parade through the street or whatever. You know, it would be a great victory. And one of the things that The Wire keeps coming back to is like that never happens. Like you never get that decisive final victory over whoever, you know, when you're policing or something like that. Like, it's never as you want it, right? You're never going to get them for all the charges that you would like, or they're never going to go away. Or even when you do, it's sort of undercut. And when you do get someone, you know, there's always something else. Like, it never stops. There is no end. And, you know, in Omar realizing sort of his vengeance, he has sort of denied, I guess you would call it, like, a American style resolution that we would expect with McNulty. And then McNulty is just like, oh, like, this guy who I've been working for years to try to put away, he's dead now. And now I just have to go do something else.
Well, and here's the thing. The people who understand that are the people who understand that world. Omar absolutely understands it. McNulty does not understand it. Because when Stringer Bell gets killed, he's really sort of upset because he wanted to, in his mind, the story was going to play out the way you said, because that's the way the story plays out. He's the hero. He catches Stringer Bell and everything works out.
Yeah.
There's this moment in a later episode when Marlo is coming up, when he is stealing a lollipop and a security guard tells him to stop it. And the security guard is one of the people who's going to end up dead in a boarded up building. But Marlo says something to him. The security guard said, look, I gotta ask you to give that back. And Marlo says, the problem with you is you think things are one way, but they aren't that way. So this idea that you want things to work according to rules, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't steal, give things back if you're caught stealing, that those are rules, but they don't apply.
Yeah.
McNulty wants things to be one way, but they aren't that way.
Which is why he's so miserable and pisses everyone off and is just like a person that can't be like, he can never be happy, right? Because it's not according to, he has an idea of police work that is just untenable and unrealistic. And, you know, and then, but guys like Lester or Bunk, who kind of get it more, and, like, you know, Lester is kind of the wiser sage character. He's like, that's not how, you know, in the kind of the same way where Lester keeps telling McNulty, like, that's not how it's going to be. And, like, you just got to learn how to, like, make your peace with that and, like, live your life and, like, find what happiness you can, because, like, you're never going to get that kind of resolution that you so crave.
Let me give you my last two.
My last two
pieces, because I had four things that I felt were kind of that were the key pieces of evidence that tied this all up. So the other two scenes, so that you've got the shout and the running, which I think are pivotal for this idea that there is in the back of Simon's mind, if nothing else, the Iliad itself and not just the idea of Achilles. But you have an arming scene, a literal Homeric arming scene in the prison. So Omar is framed for a murder and he's sent to the county jail to await trial, I guess. And Marlo puts a price on his head. And so people in the prison want to kill him. And at the end of one episode, these two menacing looking guys come in and he thinks that they're going to attack him. But it turns out that they are friends of his mentor, Butchie's. Mm-hmm. And Butchie is an older blind man who is both Phoenix and, you know, in some ways Homer, right?
Yeah.
If you want to start mapping people on, right?
I was wondering if you were going to ask that, but I didn't want to, like,
I don't know. I mean, again, I think it's not about a one-to-one sort of mechanical mapping. It's about impressions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. That you have these floating signifiers like blindness, like mentorship, like the lovers that Omar has that all, they don't have to map on exactly, but they create this image. One of the guys in that scene is the real life guy that Omar is based on.
Oh, yeah.
So this guy, Donnie Adams, is actually the person who did a lot of the stuff that Omar does, which is kind of interesting in itself. But in the next episode, they know that he is going to, like, Donnie Andrews, not Donnie Adams. They know that he's going to be attacked. And so they bring in an atlas and a bunch of phone books, and they start strapping them around his chest. And that is an arming scene of the sort that you get continually in the Iliad, where they put on the cuirass and the greaves and the rest. And he stands there and it all happens pretty silently, and they wrap it around him. And so that, I think, is another reference, because it's both accurate and incongruous, right? How would you have a Homeric arming scene? You know, people would put on a bulletproof vest, or they would, you know, get a gun or something. But this is literally, he has a shiv and some phone books taped to him that are put on by these two guys who are essentially arming him. And it is highly effective in the next scene. So that's another place where I think the intersection, and I think that's part of what's going on. It's not that David Simon is saying, I'm going to retell the Iliad, but I'm just going to frame it in terms of Baltimore. And it's not that he's ignoring the Iliad. It's that he is like, these are the same places somehow, mm-hmm. right? That this is an imprint that is repeating itself in these different places and times, which is why it feels natural and real, right? That's not a weird scene where you're like, why are they putting phone books on him? You're like, of course they're putting phone books on him, yeah. because what else would you do? So that's another moment that I thought was meant to recall to those who had read the Iliad, the idea of the arming of the hero. And then the last is the very last few minutes of the very last episode of the series. And people have talked about the very last part, which is McNulty bringing the guy that he said had been killed back to Baltimore, and the city itself fills the view and the city becomes the protagonist. But right before that, Marlowe, the drug kingpin, who had taken out Omar and who has basically succeeded where Stringer Bell has failed. He's made it into legitimacy. He has set aside the business. He has a ton of money. He's investing in real estate. And he feels completely at sea in this society and in this place where he finds himself. And he leaves this fancy party where he is being asked to schmooze with politicians and developers. And he walks out to the corner. And he walks up on two corner boys who are standing out there. And they're shooting the shit. And if you're not paying attention, they're just talking about something. But if you listen closely, what they're talking about is Omar. And specifically, what they're talking about is Omar's death. Mm-hmm. But now Omar's death is not clearly different stories are circulating in which the police shot him, or maybe a gang shot him, or maybe some hitmen from New York shot him. And one of the boys on the corner is saying, no, it wasn't any of those guys. There were 9 guys and they were all armed and Omar had an AK-47. And Marlowe walks up to them and picks a fight. And he says, what are you looking at? And the corner boys say, we're looking at you. And Marlowe says, do you know who I am? And they don't have any idea who he is. Mm-hmm. So Marlowe's name has disappeared. In winning, his Kleos is gone. And right. Omar's name, in dying, has become immortalized and sort of is taking on this ballooning mythic significance.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Right? Which is that's
the Achilles choice.
The right? Achilles choice, mm-hmm. right? And that there it is, right at the end, right? That's our last word on the street is Omar's myth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that is really hard to ignore. And I will say, I think, again, that the way Simon does this is incredibly smart, because not only does he not try to do one-to-one, which wouldn't make any sense, not only does he sort of merge Iliadic and Western themes, which merge on their own by virtue of their role in the way Americans think about America and American myths, but some of the parts of it, which look Iliadic and look like Achilles stories, are actually Donnie Andrews stories. So Achilles and his invincibility, the first time I saw Omar jump out of the third story window when he was caught in this ambush in a townhouse and survive and break a leg, but go on fighting, I was like, oh, that, of course, like he's just like Achilles. But that was based on an actual episode where Donnie Andrews jumped out of a higher window in a building in a similar situation and survived. So the guy who is taking Omar around, Butchie's friend who gives him the armor, is the guy who actually did these things in real life and became himself kind of a local legend. So that you have this fusing of reality and myth and modernity and antiquity in these really complicated ways. It would be one thing if you just made up stories, and another thing if you just told real stories. But what happens when the real stories look a lot like the fictional stories, and the fictional stories themselves look a lot like the Iliad from, you know, 8th century BC? It is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Ah, this is so cool.
Yeah. I have like 3 thoughts that the one going with the end there is, I like that the premise of The Wire and like listening about payphones and beepers and everything just made me think of like old ways of communicating. But like so much of this, including the very end of people telling the story of Omar and his death, like this is oral history. This is mythologizing in the making through word of mouth, which is what it's always been, which is a really cool connection there. I was wondering if you saw a connection with the Sunday truce and Briseis and this idea of social norms being broken, which also is contributing to the wrath of Achilles, where it's like there's no hard, there's no laws that you have to treat people a certain way in warfare, but there are these expectations. And if those expectations are broken,
then shoot off an old woman's crown.
Like, yeah. How would you?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I thought a lot about that episode because it seemed like it would be the kind of thing that you could work in. But I think it's one of those places where the underlying feeling is somehow more important than the direct parallelism. Because you definitely have this turn in the Iliad where clearly things have been going according to particular rules up until about book six or seven. And in the past, right, the period before that, where people are captured on the battlefield, when they surrender, they're taken prisoner and ransomed and given back, where, you know, the
funeral games. I mean,
yeah, I was going to say funeral games.
And the rules of hospitality and guest friendship apply. You can exchange gifts and have a bond and, you know, set aside your duel, this, you know, that weird duel between Hector and Ajax, which just, it starts to get dark and they're like, okay, I guess nobody's going to win. Let's just have presents and go home. And then things become increasingly savage until you've got people being murdered in their sleep in book 10. And I think that you can argue, I guess, that this is mapping onto that idea, right? That certain boundaries are being crossed as things escalate. But I couldn't figure out a way to try to make it.
It didn't seem like a perfect fit like some of the other ones you were pointing out, but it was still something that was important to Omar. Like, and like everyone knew the significance of that attack too. So it's like, it's like everyone knew a social rule was broken, but.
There are rules of engagement that we should play by.
Okay. So my third one and my last one is that I've also discussed with students about thinking about Homer and who he's creating this epic for, if Homer's a real person, which I get, but who the story is made for. And on the one hand, it is, you know, promoting this way of life for elite warrior males. At the same time, also carefully in its language showing like how problematic that institution and system is. And this is really interesting, coming out in 2002, not long after 9/11, where you could argue there's going to be a huge push for support of cops. And even today, there's discussions of copaganda and things like that. Do you see more broadly the Wire kind of doing the same thing of upholding some of those ideals while underhandedly challenging them? I haven't seen enough of it to like fully come to that conclusion, but I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
This came up, I listened to like NPR has a pop culture podcast, and they were talking about The Wire recently, and this was one of the questions that they were fielding, like, is The Wire propaganda? And I'm in agreement with them, which is generally no, in a sense that like we have humanized police characters, but like you don't necessarily, I don't think you walk away from The Wire thinking that like policing the way we're doing it is a good idea. And then you get an insight as sort of like the structural problems with it. And kind of in the same way, like there's a question that I sort of like, or and that I sort of like to ask in the Iliad is, and I forget who said this originally, but a film critic or a director said something to the effect of like, I don't like war movies because they're all kind of inherently pro-war. Like even the ones that are ostensibly about how bad war is kind of make war look awesome. And I asked this question about the Iliad, like, is the Iliad a pro-war pro-war work? And I know I have my sort of read, but like, how much of that is what I'm bringing to the text? And because clearly other people have read the Iliad and thought war was a great idea, like Alexander the Great, who, you know, slept with it under his pillow every night, supposedly, while he went to go conquer Persia.
Right.
Styling himself as Achilles, you know, made anew. And so, yeah, I think that's a very sort of similar kind of question of like, is the Iliad to war and The Wire to policing, right? Like, is that in like, what's like, yay or nay, to reduce Christie's question to that? And I'm inclined to say no, but Adam is going to tell me why I'm wrong.
No. I'm not going to say that you're wrong. I'm sort of thinking this through as you speak. Because what I was thinking is there is a documentary called Coringall about it's a photojournalist, Sebastian Unger, I think it was, who was embedded with a forward operating base in Afghanistan. And one of the things that comes out of this, which I think comes out of the Iliad as well, is that people like war movies and think that they make war look awesome because in some ways it is awesome. That is, people experience a rush in battle that the soldiers they're talking to say is like nothing else. Right. And you know, it is, you have this feeling of power and it is addictive, but then also awful things happen to you, to the people that you're fighting against, to civilians in the course of that addiction. So it is both awful and desirable at the same time, like addiction, which is a huge theme that runs through the whole Wire with Bubbles. Mm-hmm. And the cops are addicted too. Not only is McNulty an alcoholic, but they are addicted to these certain behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. To doing things a certain way. So everybody is addicted, and addiction feels good, but is terrible, right? And it hurts you and the people around you, but also you can't stop doing it because it feels so good when you're in the middle of it, when you're drunk or high or shooting up. And so I think that I would view it in that kind of way, right? That it isn't really talking about whether the police are good or the police are bad, but about the way in which this kind of work is addictive, and addictive in the same destructive ways as a drug addiction.
And I forget who says this. It might have been Rawls or it might have been like Bunk, but somebody to McNulty says explicitly, like, your addiction is to yourself. Like, you're addicted to yourself and your own self-righteousness or whatever, however you want to take that meaning or something like that. But yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, the addictive. I like that reading of like the addictiveness of these pursuits and everything that entails.
Yeah. Now, I was just thinking of like the very horribly violent like instances of like police brutality that are shown in The Wire. Like, I don't know, 2002, I feel like before there were huge, you know, big news stories that really focused on police brutality in just this very like casual, you know, this exists and everybody knows it exists. We just don't talk about it in that really, really horrible, ambiguous way where it's exactly what we've been saying this whole time. It's like, I like these characters. Sometimes they make terrible choices and you scream at them to stop. And that's part of the human story. It's like, you know, you don't want Hector to go out to fight Achilles. We don't want Patroclus to put on Achilles' armor. Like, we know how these terrible choices end. And we don't want, like, you know, D'Angelo to try to go out on his own and be his own person. He needs the support while he's on the inside. And it's, yeah, we can see it coming and we still can't get out of this oppressive grind.
And then one of the arcs that this is kind of having me thinking of is Kima. And kind of, I feel like what we see with Kima is how she basically perpetuates all of the, you know, the way this lifestyle, the way this job, being a cop, the way she kind of is obsessed with it and you know, she takes policing and kind of models or mirrors, at least, like McNulty in that sense. But it like completely destroys her life. She does think, you know, she is also perpetuating cycles of violence and brutality upon people in Baltimore, destroys her relationship with her wife or partner, and perpetuates and manifests in like drinking and affairs and things like that. I don't know. She's like almost like, she's like Neoptolemus or Diomedes or somebody, like you start bringing in the second generations to Troy and it's going to destroy them just like it destroyed the Achilleses and the whoever's or something like that. Again, not to like make too strong of a one-to-one.
And I kind of like Michael B. Jordan's character Wallace, because I think after Brandon dies and he sees the body, and he's like, it doesn't necessarily have to be like this. And it's like, I like that. I like that idea. But very quickly, by the end of the episode, is bought in to just continue the whole process. Mm-hmm. So there's always, especially with the younger generation, of like, I want to strike out. I want to do something different. It can be better. We don't have to, you know, continue this circle of violence. And yet it's too hard to break out of it at the same time.
Yeah, like Bodhi, right? You want Bodhi to get out of it, and nope.
Mm-hmm. No, they buy it. That's their coming of age, right? Like that's the moment where they're like, we're all in. And so we will shoot our own friend.
You do. I mean, you get a Neoptolemus at the end because Michael mm-hmm. goes from being Marlowe's enforcer to being a new Omar, knocking off a, you know, yeah. the center of a business in that rim shop.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, I mean, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there is a series that's out now on one of the streaming services called We Own This City about the gun task force in Baltimore that is David Simon and George Pelicanos.
Okay.
And half of the actors in it are from The Wire, but they've all been shuffled around. So Marlowe is now like an earnest homicide detective. And I realized that one of the beat cops is Dookie from season 5 as well. And like, it's crazy. Or okay. I guess season 4 was the schools.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that one is so clearly about corrupt policing.
Yeah.
That it's very hard to take it as an endorsement of the
in blue. So we just Trojan horsed it in with The Wire and then we can
there we go. More. There yeah. we go. Let's
play with it later on.
Absolutely.
All right. This was so cool. I'm so glad that we got to have this discussion. Thank you so much, Adam.
Did I convince you? Did you buy my pitch?
I'm totally convinced.
I'm predisposed to like professionally, for professional and personal reasons, I'm predisposed to kind of buy into these things. But I see it. The real question is, so I have to go to my sister and brother-in-law are both lawyers who live in Baltimore, but they are like the biggest Wire heads. Obviously the show had like resonates at a level, and they like at their wedding the tables were named after characters from The Wire. I think I was at Prop Joe, which now when I look back at it, I'm like, come on, Anna. Like,
come on.
But anyways, what I was getting is that I gotta go to them and see like did we convince you to read the Iliad or whatever it is, or that like, you know, that there's something going on.
Right.
So that's going to be the litmus test. I'll follow up.
Perfect.
And there is, I have to say, there is something about Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in Baltimore.
Balmer,
right. Balmer. Balmer. There's no T in it at all.
Yeah.
I lived in Balmer for a year when my wife was at that Hopkins after college. And we watched Homicide religiously, and it just that also David Simon, right? So,
yeah.
But there's something about that, the placeness of mm-hmm. that place, and its contradictions, because you really do go rapidly from wealthy neighborhood to mm-hmm. poor neighborhood, and from, you know, safe to less safe for white people who are wandering around on the streets at night. But it is such a place, such a deeply felt place in all of these shows that I can totally understand why people in Baltimore are into it.
Yeah.
Because it really only took a year and I was like, I want to watch the show all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And go down to Fells Point, you know, and look at the cop bars. And
I mean, even just stuff like the fact that they hang out eating crabs, drinking Natty Bo. That's peak Baltimore. All right. Does anyone have any sort of closing up thoughts? Otherwise, we can clear this one.
Yes, clear.
All right. We'll knock this one off. We'll put it on our report that we have, you know, cleared. We have cleared this case, and we can report good numbers to the deputy commissioner. Adam, thanks so much for coming back on the show. If people want to read or see or hear more from you, where can they do that?
So the thing I've been working on lately, apart from this Grand Challenge project, Planet Texas 2050, and the work that Elijah and I are doing at Histria in Romania, which you should definitely check out. We have an Instagram
we would in the
various,
comments.
Various other things. But I have just helped some graduate students finish a digital humanities project focused on casts of ancient sculpture in UT's collection. Mm-hmm. So we have a website with a discussion of the way in which ancient ideas and images percolate down through modernity and then sort of stick around in strange ways that aren't really one-to-one, but are visible and make sense when you see them in the same way that bits of the Iliad and Greek tragedy keep surfacing in The Wire. And it has 3D models and you can download them and paint on them and do all sorts of stuff. It has some information about polychromy and things like that. So battlecasts.la.utexas.edu.
All right. Which check also will put a link in the description. All right. Thank you all so much. It was, as always, lovely having everyone on and getting into the nuts and bolts of pop culture, ancient and modern. As usual, you can listen more Movies We Dig at moviesweDig.com. Follow us on Twitter at @DigMovies. If you still have a Twitter, which is a little bit of an open question.
Mastodon.
Yeah, we got Eli and Chris and I need to actually kind of, we should probably figure that out.
We should probably talk about that.
but you can listen to more episodes on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you can find most of the big places you can find podcasts, you can find us. Thank you again for listening, and we'll be back next week to talk more I think about our next docket is Altered Carbon, at least in the recording order, so we'll see about how it gets released. I might shuffle stuff around a bit. All right, thank you all so much, and I'll see you around. Bye.
Thank y'all.